Thank you so very much. It is just a few clicks away from 6 minutes past the hour. And a man who truly knows how to make an entrance, always early, never late. And this is a command performance, a return engagement. The distinguished doctor, the distinguished cardiac electrophysiologist from Deborah Heart and Lung Center, Dr. Pedram Kazmian, is our guest. And he is certified in both cardiovascular disease and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. Dr. Kazmian earned his medical degree and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Toronto in Canada. After residency, he completed both a fellowship in cardiology and a fellowship in clinical cardiac electrophysiology at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. Dr. Kazmian went on to complete additional fellowship training in clinical cardiac electrophysiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard University in Boston, and a fellowship in advanced clinical cardiac electrophysiology at Stuart St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, Tufts University in Boston. Dr. Kazmian's special interests include atrial fibrillation. That comes in handy because that is our big topic today. Heart failure, ablations for ventricle tachycardia. Boy, it's a good thing I can say all these, pronounce all these words, Dr. Kazmian. I think I'm getting through this. And the good doctor has participated in many, many clinical research projects and authored numerous articles in peer-reviewed medical journals. Dr. Kazmian, welcome back, sir.
Welcome. Thank you.
It is great to have you back. Our topic this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents, Dr. Kazmian, is managing atrial fibrillation, and you'll hear us interchange the two with the shorter version, AFib. Managing AFib, the topic this half hour. Dr. Kazmian, can you explain what atrial fibrillation, what AFib is, and how does it affect the heart?
Sure. So AFib is an irregular, often rapid heart rhythm. It originates from the top chamber of the heart, which is called atrium. And usually the normal heart, the electrical signal that starts from a single point and travels down the rest of the atrium and the ventricle, which are the bottom chamber. But in atrial fibrillation, it becomes random and erratic. As a result, the ventricles, which are the lower chamber, receive this disorganized signal and become irregular fast. And fast, I mean 100 beats per minute, 180 beats per minute. And this irregular rhythm can reduce the heart pumping efficiency. So the heart is able to pump less blood out, and the top chamber is really not pumping at all. So the blood remains stagnant, which I will discuss later. It increases the risk of clot formation, which can result in a stroke. Wow. It comes in different flavors. Some people have short bursts of atrial fibrillation, may last 10 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, usually less than 7 days. It's called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, but some people may stay in it for many days. Those are called persistent. Unfortunately, some people stay in it indefinitely. It's called a permanent atrial fibrillation. It comes from both the structural changes in the heart and electrical changes in the heart, but as a result, the heart function is reduced by about 20 to 25%.
Dr. Kazmian, what are some of the most common symptoms of AFib that folks listening right now could experience?
Sure. So there's a variety of symptoms. So people can experience heart palpitation, that sensation of fast or fluttering or pounding heartbeat. Some people may experience shortness of breath, so difficulty catching their breath, especially when they're doing exercise. May have fatigue or weakness with activity, with mild activity, dizziness or lightheadedness. May have chest discomfort or reduced ability to exercise. So at rest, they're okay, but when they start walking, they feel winded very easily. So there are different levels of symptoms, from sort of asymptomatic form to mildly symptomatic to severely symptomatic to even disabling symptoms when they can't even function the routine daily activities. The important group that I want to emphasize are the asymptomatic ones. So about 15 to 30% of patients really don't have any symptoms. And the danger of this is that they are equally exposed to all the adverse events that may occur in patients with atrial fibrillation. But since they don't have symptoms, they may not seek medical attention and they may remain undiagnosed. So our guidelines usually recommend people do routinely check their heart rate, sometimes opportunistic screening. For example, when they check their blood pressure, most of the blood pressure devices that people use at their home also measure their heart rate, and they may tell them that they are in atrial fibrillation. A lot of wearables, such as the smartwatches, also detect atrial fibrillation.
Just checked mine right now while you were speaking, Dr. Kazmian.
Right.
Dr. Pedram Kazmian, cardiac electrophysiologist from Deborah Heart Lung Center. The topic this half hour on Deborah Heart Lung Center Presents is managing AFib. To schedule an appointment, I'm going to give you two ways to do it. You can call Deborah, Deborah Heart and Lung Center at 609-621-2080. I'll repeat, 609-621-2080, or on any digital device, smartphone, iPad, laptop, desktop, whatever, any digital device, just go to demanddeborah.org. How does age affect someone's risk of developing AFib, doctor?
Yeah, so age is one of the biggest risk factors, or one of the bigger risk factors for atrial fibrillation. It's the disease of elderly. As we get older, it becomes more common. In younger people, less than 65, is very uncommon. Less than 2% of people have AFib. Between 75 and 85, about 10%. And after 85, about 20%, which is one in five individuals over 85 have atrial fibrillation. So it's actually the most common cardiac arrhythmia in humans. Now, why is this the case? Is that as we get older, there are changes that happen in our body and in the heart, such as stresses, inflammation, and a scar that promotes it. And with advancing age, we also are exposed to other comorbidities, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, heart attack, heart failure, which all contribute to the atrial fibrillation. So as we get older, it becomes significantly more common.
Dr. Kazmian, can AFib happen to anyone, so any unsuspecting victim, or are there certain risk factors that make someone more likely to develop it? How does this work?
Yeah, so AFib can affect a wide range of people, even those without any obvious heart disease. But definitely risk factors, there are risk factors that make it more likely to develop. So these risk factors, we talked about one of them, is obviously advancing age and some degree of family history. Obviously, these are not things we can change, and we are ultimately exposed to them. Heart disease and high blood pressure, so any underlying cardiovascular condition can contribute to high blood pressure, as I mentioned, coronary heart disease, heart attack, valve diseases of the heart, heart failure, even exposure to procedures. So people have heart surgery post-operatively, they are exposed to a higher risk of developing atrial fibrillation. Non-cardiac medical condition can contribute to it, such as diabetes, chronic kidney disease, lung disease like COPD, who people, you know, smokers are exposed to, obstructive sleep apnea, overactive thyroid. There are lifestyle choices that affect or increase the risk, such as certain habits. Smoking is one of them. Excessive alcohol consumption. Obesity is a major one. And sort of stresses and illnesses. A lot of time we see patients have, say, especially in the age of COVID, they develop a pneumonia, COVID pneumonia or other form of pneumonia. And post-infection, they develop atrial fibrillation. So AFib isn't completely random, but it can happen to almost anybody, but it's far more common when we have certain risk factors, which I mentioned most of them.
We are listening to and visiting with Dr. Pedram Kazmian, cardiac electrophysiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, where Dr. Kazmian is also the director, EPS fellowship program at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. So we covered basically, and you did it so well, you explain what it is, you shared what the risk factors are. Following along the course here, what are the main causes of AFib, and are there things that people can do to reduce their risk?
Sure. So it goes along with the risk factors. So many of the causes or associated conditions, one is a heart-related condition, heart blood pressure I mentioned, coronary heart disease, heart valve diseases, congenital heart defects, you see that. Non-cardiac conditions, hyperthyroidism, which is overactive thyroid. Sleep apnea, these are people who snore at night, have difficulty sleeping. acute illnesses like pneumonia I mentioned, but any serious infection could cause it. Surgical stressors, so post-heart surgery or after other surgeries, appendicitis, appendectomy, they could get it. But there are some non-identifiable causes as well. We have patients who come in with AFib, and we cannot find any of these above-mentioned conditions. So these are, we call them lone atrial fibrillation. We can't find any of the risk factors or causes. We can take many steps to lower these risks, obviously, right? So if you have high blood pressure, we can consult with our family physician to start treatment, reduce the blood pressure. Smoking cessation, consumption of alcohol or caffeine in moderation perhaps is okay, but if you can abstain from it, that would be even better. One of the important ones is physical activity. So there were trials done, and I'll probably come back to it later, that if we can do about 2.5 hours of even moderate physical activity during the week, that can reduce the rate of atrial fibrillation. Losing weight is a significant step we can take. So if we can reduce 10% even in our body weight, that reduces the risk of recurrence of AFib by about 50%, which is very significant. The alcohol I mentioned, but even one or two drinks per day, which is considered in some circles to be moderate consumption, it increases our risk by about 8%. Sleep is a significant issue. So if people have a sleep apnea, can seek medical treatment. We use CPAP, for example, with these patients, and that has been shown to reduce the recurrence rate of atrial fibrillation. Overall, if we can address three or more of these what we call modifiable risk factor, things that we can change, unlike aging, for example, we don't have control over. If we can change three or more of these, we can reduce the risk of AFib recurrence, for example, after treatment by about 60% or so.
Bonus question right before the one and only break that we will take during your time with us, Dr. Kazmian. Once AFib, always AFib, or could you have AFib and then at a later point, maybe you've lost a lot of weight, you start to exercise, you eat better, could you in the future not have AFib? I guess what I'm saying is once you have it, is there permanency to it?
So some AFibs are caused by what's called modifiable risks, right? So, for example, somebody developed AFib after a surgery, and once the offending cause is relieved, they may actually never have AFib after that. Somebody has overactive thyroid. Once we treat it, it may thyroid problem may go away, and AFib as well. In some patients, especially in younger people, we see AFib after they have episode of binge drinking, for example, and then they come up over the weekend, and they come out on Monday with AFib. Once they control that, it could be resolved completely and never have recurrence. Weight loss is a significant contributor, and as I mentioned, you can, with appropriate treatment and appropriate weight loss, we can either make it very infrequent or hopefully in some patients completely eliminate it.
We will be right back. Great answer. Important question. Great answer. We will be right back. More with Dr. Pedram Kazmian, cardiac electrophysiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. This is Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Kazmian, the topic this half hour, and the doctor will be with us until 36 minutes past the hour. The topic this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Pedram Kazmian is managing AFib. And when we come back, the question on the floor will be, how is AFib diagnosed? Does it require special testing? Multi-part question. Can it be detected during a routine checkup? That and more as we continue right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. Thank you so much. Welcome back. We are visiting this half hour with Dr. Pedram Kazmian, cardiac electrophysiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And our topic this half hour is managing AFib. The question on the floor is multi-part. How is AFib diagnosed? Does it require special testing? Or can it be detected during a routine checkup? Dr. Kazmian, time is yours.
Sure. So diagnosing AFib is usually easy. You can have a routine physical examination and take your physician or nurse can take your pulse or listen to your heart and detect some irregularity that may prompt them to think that the patient may have AFib. But it has to be confirmed, and we usually need something called an electrocardiogram, which can be done in the office. That put the stickers on the chest and essentially record electrical activity of the heart, and that will confirm the patient has atrial fibrillation. The problem that often we face is that, as I mentioned previously, one form of AFib is called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. These are patients who have bouts of AFib, maybe for an hour, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 5 hours. And in that day or time when they go to see their physician, they may not be in atrial fibrillation. Even if they do electrocardiogram, they're not going to see atrial fibrillation. So for these patients, we need longer-term monitoring. We have devices that we can adhere to the chest wall. They can wear them for a couple of weeks, sometimes longer, and detect AFib that is in the paroxysmal form, so comes and goes. Nowadays, as I mentioned, there are consumer devices, watches, smart watches that can monitor heart rate and heart rhythm throughout the day, as long as they're wearing their watches. And some of them are artificial intelligence detection, where it even notifies patients that they are in atrial fibrillation.
The progression to where we are right now is it's been masterclass. What it is, what are the common symptoms, risk factors, can it happen to anyone, what are the main causes, how is it diagnosed, and all of this. So now we're just going to put it out there. You've got it. You have AFib. Someone is diagnosed with it. How is it typically treated?
Right. So the treatment really two main goals. One is the managing the rhythm, so or rate in some patients. And the second one, preventing complications, which main one is really a stroke. There are certain medications that we can use for controlling the heart rate. They reduce the rate at the bottom, in the bottom chamber of the heart. Some of the your audience may be using some of these medications like metoprolol, atenolol, diltiazem. The patient still stays in atrial fibrillation, but the heart rate is controlled. So it's not ideally, it's around 80, 90 beats per minute, but definitely not in range of 120, 130. This doesn't address necessarily all the symptoms. Ideally, we want to get the patient out of atrial fibrillation, and more importantly, keep them in atrial fibrillation. To achieve that goal, we have what's called class of medication called antiarrhythmic medications. Unfortunately, they have success rate around 40 to 50%, and some of them have long-term side effects, which we try to avoid in a long-term use. I will come back later to other treatments that have much better success rate. To achieve the second goal, which is prevent a stroke, we put patients on blood thinners. Of course, those are who have a strong risk for developing a stroke. And we try to also address the underlying condition that in the first place resulted in them developing the atrial fibrillation. So treat the overactive thyroid, treat the sleep apnea, and then guide them to lifestyle changes, to lose weight, increase their physical activity, adjust their diet, reduce alcohol consumption, quit smoking, manage stress, those sort of things. So I mentioned the medication to manage the rhythm are not really extremely successful, but fortunately we have procedures that can be successful in getting patients out of atrial fibrillation and keeping them in regular rhythm. So usually we do what's called the cardioversion, so that restores the rhythm back to normal rhythm. And we have what's called ablation therapy. So these are day procedures nowadays that take about an hour, 20 minutes to perform. And the patient can go home same day. There's some restrictions for a couple of days not to do excessive physical activity. And in the right person, it has success rate up to 85%.
You are listening to Dr. Pedram Kazmian, cardiac electrophysiologist at Deborah Heart Lung Center, to schedule an appointment. At Deborah Heart Lung Center, you can call 609-621-2080. That's 609-621-2080. And I promise you, from any digital device, you will see the hyperlink right to scheduling. You can't miss it. on the homepage at demanddebora.org. So you talked about some, you did the medications, the lifestyle changes and all, and some of the procedures and things. You mentioned earlier in your program, Dr. Kazmian, that with AFib comes an increased risk of stroke. There is something that I think some of your listeners will definitely have heard of this, known as the acronym LAAO, left atrial appendage occlusion procedure. Tell our listeners, how does that work?
Yeah, so I have to answer that. So one of the most dangerous complications of AFib is a stroke, because the atria does not contract. Atria are the two top chambers of the heart. They don't contract during AFib. They kind of quiver and fibrillate. And so blood is a stagnant, and the stagnant blood, as you know, can form a blood clot. So we put this patient on blood thinner. However, some patients are unable to take blood thinner because of the risk of bleeding or the coexistent bleeding from the other organs, gastrointestinal or central nervous system. The alternative that has been available and now is widely used is this device. It's called left atrial appendage occluders. There are two companies that make them. And what they do is that the clot that is formed in the top chamber doesn't form anywhere, but in one area is called left atrial appendage, which is essentially a cul-de-sac. And if we can occlude that cul-de-sac and prevent the blood from pooling in that area, we can essentially prevent a stroke. And this would be a substitute for using blood thinner. This is also a day procedure. They come to the hospital. It's done through the access, through the groin. They sleep during the procedure. And after that, they would be able to come off the blood thinner safely without being exposed to increased risk of a stroke or bleeding in this case. So it's a mechanical solution to reduce the risk of a stroke that may be suitable for patients who are unable to take blood thinners.
Dr. Kazmian, can you explain, I think this is so critical in this point of your program, how AFib impacts a person's daily life and how they can, in fact, live well while managing it?
Right. So, living with AFib could be challenging, obviously. So it's not just a minor inconvenience for a lot of people. So symptoms and exercise tolerance is one of them. So if you have AFib, you may not be able to do physical activity. You get short of breath, winded very easily. Although I mentioned about 50 to 30% may be also asymptomatic. If you can manage AFib well, both from the rate and rhythm management, it can significantly change their exercise tolerance. So they may go back to the routine daily activities that we used to do without any restriction. There are some emotional impacts and anxiety. As I mentioned, one of the issues with AFib is the risk of a stroke. And you can imagine if you're constantly under this worry that you may get a stroke, that could affect your life. So managing this aspect is very important. So we educate patients about what AFib is and how they can prevent the risk of a stroke. Nowadays, with the sort of wearables and electronics that are available, monitoring and medical routine follow-up is an aspect that gives patients some control over their life and how their AFib is managed, and that allays some of the fears they have generally. Lifestyle adjustments are important, so certain triggers can make AFib worse in some people. So you can choose to adjust your lifestyle to avoid this kind of a roller coaster heart rate. Example would be limiting alcohol and caffeine intake. If you notice this precipitate these episodes, then we can cut them down or eliminate them if possible. Managing stress is important. So high stress, anxiety, is sometimes unavoidable, but sometimes we can control it. If you can reduce it, that will reduce the risk of AFib recurrence. So techniques such as yoga, meditation, those sort of things, adjusting the or treating the sleep apnea so that patients can get good sleep at night, good health. And then there are safety considerations. So if some patients with AFib may feel dizziness and may feel, even extreme cases may pass out. So if somebody has AFib symptoms and while driving they become lightheaded, it's important for them to pull over, obviously, for safety reasons, seek medical attention. We can put a monitor on them. And in some patients, appropriately treat them so this wouldn't happen. So living well with AFib is absolutely possible. We need to follow a treatment plan that addresses all those things that I mentioned above. Adopt a heart healthy habit, you know, smoking cessation, reducing alcohol consumption, and sort of stay connected with your healthcare providers so that we can review these things as they arise, because not everybody has the same set of symptoms or has the same set of medical conditions. So it has to be individualized for individual patients.
Talk about, and I think you are, but just as a point of emphasis, talk about how important the need in terms of ongoing management is.
Right. So AFib typically requires ongoing, I mean, long-term management, right? So in most cases, AFib is just not one-time event. It's a recurring thing. Unfortunately, it tends to be chronic in some patients. So this means that even after initial treatment, that they need to come in and continuously manage and follow up. So what are these follow-ups entail? So regular medical follow-ups is you go to your doctor periodically every 6 months or a year and adjust some of the medications. Some are up, some down, depending on the response to treatment. So, for example, I mentioned one of the medication was beta blocker, metoprolol, one of them. And so if the heart rate is too low, they may have to cut down the rate, the dose of it. The patient should expect to have occasional tests. We may repeat ECGs. We may order long-term monitoring devices to check the burden of AFib. They may need blood work to check the thyroid, the kidney function, depending on what medication they're on, the level of blood thinner that they're on, they may have to be adjusted. So they stay engaged in the follow-up process is very important for them. Daily medication adherence is also important for patients, right? So many of these blood thinners have a half-life of 12 hours or 24 hours. So if they miss doses during the time that they're not taking it, they could be exposed to risk of a stroke. We don't want lifestyle changes. Often require continuous reminding the patient about the importance of them to encourage them to adhere with them. So long-term follow-up is absolutely necessary.
Final question, final minute with Dr. Kazmian. DeBoer Heart and Lung Center presents this important discussion on atrial fibrillation, managing AFib. What advice, closing comment, do you have for someone who has been living with AFib?
If you've been living with AFib, you probably already know the basics of the management. So I'll focus on advice that can help you live your best life with this condition. So stay proactive and informed. Go to your doctor, ask questions. Now, there are many sources online that you probably read about this, but confirm it with your physician. Work closely with your healthcare providers, you know, your regular checkup. I encourage patients who have one of these smartwatches to check their heart rate regularly or heart rhythm. They often have what's called an ECG app on their phone or their watch that they can check the rhythm during the day multiple times. Adhere to your treatment, so take your medication as prescribed. Don't miss them, because when you miss, for example, the blood thinner, you are exposed to risk of a stroke. Look for the triggers that bring the AFib. In some patients, I mentioned you can find these triggers. Could be alcohol, could be poor sleep, and a lot of them are modifiable. They can change. You know, keep the stress in check. If you know, yoga and other methods that you can use to adjust and reduce your stress would be helpful. Don't be afraid. You know, in proper management, most, if not all, patients can live a healthy life without any restrictions. And know when to seek help. You know, if you have neurologic symptoms, for example, that could be a sign of a stroke. So go see your doctor very quickly, or as quickly as possible. Don't worry about this. And obviously, if you have questions, be happy to answer your questions in person.
To schedule an appointment, 609-621-2080, 609-621-2080, or on the digital platform of DeBoer Heart and Lung Center at demanddeborah.org. Dr. Kazmian, you are a delight to interview with. Have a great day, sir. Keep saving lives.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.